ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Every day we pick up our smartphones or open up our laptop and we have a clear picture of how technology has changed and even shaped our personal lives, especially in the workplace. What we may not be thinking about, though, is the impact that that technology is having on our relationships, especially those with our family. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to talk with a UWM professor who says our digital lives are now deeply linked to our social experiences. Noelle Chesley is an associate professor of sociology in UWM's College of Letters and Science, where she's also director of undergraduate studies. Welcome, Noelle. Great to have you on today's program.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You know, as I was getting ready for today's program, I was reminded of an incident that occurred in my neighborhood the other day when I'm cutting the lawn. Got back from being out of town. The lawn is long. I'm pushing my mower through it. And I glance up and I see two kids, must have been 9, maybe 10 years old, and they're both on their smartphones. And I shouldn't have been surprised, but it just was so jarring because these kids were so young, so small, and here they've got their own devices. And I was then struck by the fact that, oh my God, it is everywhere, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a couple of things to think about when we talk about technology and family life. First of all, just as you mentioned, it is deeply embedded everywhere. So smartphones are probably one of the most visible things that we think about. But the technology in terms of digital assistants, computers in the home, media and screens everywhere, even the technology that we have to interact with as part of our personal life, when we purchase things in stores, we're using a lot of automated devices there.
And we're being tracked there?
Absolutely. We're definitely being tracked everywhere. It's ubiquitous in that way, for sure.
And it's not new. As I was doing some research for today's program, I stumbled across some information that 100 years ago, people may have been feeling the same shockwave that we here in the 21st century feel when we look at tablets, right?
Right, right. So that's definitely an important thing to talk about. The conversations we're having today about technology aren't new. They're part of a much longer history and debate that we've been having as a society about the role of innovation and how it, what its implications might be for people's family life, what it might say about personal life and our personal interactions with other people. So back when the printing press was just coming online and we started to have access to a lot more books, there was a panic then about the epidemic of reading, young people reading too much, and what was the novel going to do in terms of corrupting young minds, and they should, you know, be doing other things with their time than just sitting around reading these books all the time. And then later versions of that came out with the telephone. We worried a lot, not initially, but as the phone started to get brought into people's homes, we worried a lot about how it interrupted family time, for one thing, the kinds of access it gave people to others in the family within the home. That same conversation was repeated again with television. And all of this is not to say that there weren't real concerns around those things. Those conversations sometimes get labeled as moral panics. And I actually don't like that phrase because I think that there were real concerns that people had around those changes. But that said, you know, we're having the same kinds of conversations today about, is it appropriate for young children to carry around cell phones?
So is it different today, though, because the technology is so much more sophisticated and so much more pervasive than that novel that might have shown up on someone's desk 150 years ago? I mean, should we be more concerned?
Well, this is always the debate. Is it different this time around? So we can see a lot of similarities to things that have happened in previous rounds of technological innovation, some of the same concerns coming up. But some of those concerns were legitimate. And in fact, when we had debates about television, for example, and the kinds of content that kids were being exposed to, some of those debates were picking out really important problems that we wanted to pay attention to, and we regulated some of that so that we didn't have kids seeing certain types of advertisements or not having access to certain kinds of content. And I think that some of the same questions that we're having now about when is the appropriate age for kids to have access to things, to a cell phone, what sorts of things should they be watching? Should we be worried about whether or not people we don't want communicating with our kids can through all these channels that we have now? There is a sense that that some of that is new. I think the way I would put it is that it's perhaps intensifying concerns that we've had in previous rounds of technological innovation.
And also it seems because of wireless devices today, you can't get away from it. I mean, when you think back to your examples of when telephones first came on the scene, well, you had to be somewhere where that telephone line connected to a receiver. And the same with television. You weren't able to stream sports highlights or Jimmy Kimmel Live highlights on your smartphone when you're sitting on the bus. So that also is a difference from what we had in previous generations.
Well, it's definitely an intensifying. So there's been sort of a growing access issue. We've been figuring out different ways to access one another. And you're right. Now we're in a situation where access is 24/7 for the most part, which is why I was asked to do an interview, I think, about a year ago about technology-free vacations. So there are starting to be, you know, hotels and other social spaces that are trying to be completely technology-free in order to give people a space where they don't have to have those kinds of interactions, which I found fascinating.
Oh, my God, we're paying for interventions.
Exactly. And what that really speaks to, though, is this idea that, first of all, I usually talk about a technology infrastructure. So like you said, it's not any one thing. It's a bunch of different devices. It's the wireless component, the ability to use all of it anywhere. And that all creates this infrastructure that's very embedded now in our social life. And what that means for individuals is that we're past the point for this round of innovation where we can kind of say no to some of this stuff. Because now there's expectations about being accessible, about, you know, that everyone will have access to certain types of devices. And that can make it harder for individuals to challenge any of the practices or the uses of those things.
So as a sociologist, how do you and your colleagues, fellow sociologists, step back and study this? Because you yourselves are surrounded by and you have the same embedding of that technology in your own lives.
Yeah, well, that's a problem for any person who studies other people in general. So we use a lot of different methods. We use survey methods. We go out and talk to people. We observe people. We use archival materials to try to understand what's happening in something like technology and family life. And we try to have a lot of people critique our work. That's probably the best way because you're right. You can have kind of blinders on yourself from your own experience as a person using technology.
So are there differences in how different parts of our society are impacted by this pervasive technology? Let's begin with gender, first of all. Do men and women use or react to this pervasive technology the same way?
There's been definitely research that's looked at that's a broad question. So I guess I should say it depends on what type of technology we're looking at and in what kind of social context. But in the context of family life, I can say from some of my own research that we've looked at how a lot of the communication technologies impact family relationships. And women have a history of being the what sociologists call the kinkeepers in families. So these are part of their role historically has been to help maintain both the nuclear family relationships and the extended family relationships. And in previous, you know, historical periods, we were the letter writers or the, you know, the documenters of the family history. In this round, we're the emailers and the social media users. And some of my work, you know, has shown that women were using email, for example, much more than men to help maintain some of those family relationships. And it was a very positive experience for them. So women were more likely to say that email helped them feel closer to their family members, for example, than men.
What about social media platforms like Facebook or Instagram? Any research on that?
I'm sure there is, and I'm not familiar with it right off the top of my head.
I know that they're listening and watching to everything we're saying, but I'm sure there will be a lot of research in coming years.
Yeah, well, actually, on the social media gender piece, what I can say, I guess I was thinking about women-men differences, there are definitely differences in boys and girls. So girls are the big social media users when we're talking about younger humans. They tend to text and use social media more than boys do. Boys are gamers. Gaming is becoming almost universal among young boys and
tuned into boys. Twitch all the time, right?
Or Fortnite, as most parents know. This is kind of a big one right now. And so some of the gender differences that we're talking about and how that impacts relationships could be emerging right now from how younger people are using some of these different platforms.
And what about the age? You talk about the differences between males and females. Any sense of how younger versus older people use social media?
Broadly, for sure. Yeah. So we know that the people who are least likely to sort of embrace the technological society tend to be those who are 65 and older. We often in social science use that 65 age as our cutoff for the quote unquote older segment of the population, which is not to say that people who are older aren't using technology. Everybody's pretty much using it. But if we're looking at the segment that is least likely to use it, it is older people. And
yeah, my 89-year-old aunt just called the other day and said, I got a smartphone. And
yeah.
I thought, wow, congratulations. This is cool, Aunt Mary.
Right. And part of it is that we often get introduced to whatever the new innovation is of our time through our work in some kind of way. So if you're already kind of past that phase of your life, you may not have adopted, some of the tools that younger people are using. But there is research that shows that older people will respond especially to what their grandchildren are doing, and that can be a push for picking up a smartphone or learning how to text or video chat.
Suddenly FaceTime is something you want to learn how to do and want to do frequently.
Right.
You've got that loved one at the other end.
Right. And perhaps your adult children are kind of pushing you to do that to stay in contact with the grandkids too.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio today is Noelle Chesley. Noelle is an associate professor of sociology in UWM's College of Letters and Science, and we're talking about the research she's doing on the impact that technology has on our lives, particularly the impact on our relationships with families and with other people. I know that as an instructor, you give grades. Mm-hmm. That's part of the college routine. You make sure that our students are on track. Could you give us your grade on how well we as a society are using technology? Would you say that if you were to step back and try to be as objective as you can, that we're pretty much on top of things, we're doing things well, or do you think that there's a lot of room for improvement or concern about the way we're allowing technology to shape our relationships with our loved ones?
Probably I'd put us at a B-. I'm somewhere in the middle. There's definitely research evidence of benefits associated with technology use that speak to the ways that it strengthens family relationships and family life. So we know that, for instance, having access to these great computers in our pockets, these smartphones, is a wonderful coordination tool for families, a way that families stay in contact. It helps us cross distance with our extended families, as social media does, and being able to send an email and all those different channels of communication.
So there's a real plus side here.
definitely a plus side. Where there's concern, I think, definitely comes down to parent-child relationships and what's happening with kids. We know that a fair number of parents are concerned about their kids' use of screens and devices and their fascination with a lot of these tools. We know that parents are using a lot of different strategies to try to manage that. What the research hasn't documented as well as we might like, I think, is how effective some of those strategies are and what the both the good and bad consequences of some of those strategies might be.
Is there any research yet that gives us a signal of how young is too young to put a smartphone into the hands of a kid, their own smartphone? The 9-year-old that I saw walking by past my house the other day, sounding as serious and as involved and engaged in the conversation as a 40-year-old.
Right. So one thing that's really important for parents out there to know is that there are media guidelines that are developed by the American Academy of Pediatrics, and they're very much linked to kids' age, and they are research-based. So, for example, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that really young kids, 18 months or younger, aren't interacting at all with technology, except maybe for that video chat with grandma. You know that might be okay. And then they have recommendations to sort of go up from there. You know, maybe you get an hour for a toddler, and then they've got some guidelines about how to manage technology as kids get older. There is some really fascinating research right now about especially adolescents, I think, that is a little bit disturbing. It disturbs me both as a scholar and a parent about kids, older kids' technology use and how they're developing in terms of their interpersonal skills and how that might be affecting their mental health. And so there, I think parents especially or people who work with young people should be really trying to help kids manage their use, make sure they're not using too much, make sure they're getting opportunities to interact face-to-face, both with their peers and with other people in the family.
You mentioned peers. That's a huge factor here because it's one thing for us to say to our kids, you know, we're just going to hold off on getting that phone or that tablet, or you've got a tablet in school and you've got a laptop there. You know, that's good, but when you come home, you're going to be sitting at the desktop and you're going to be monitored. And yet that same kid may say, I have all of my friends have their own phone. You know, all of my friends have as much time on screen as they like. How come I'm different? What do you say?
Yeah, this kind of goes back to the point I was making about how all this stuff is so embedded in our social life now. So you just mentioned a couple things that are really important. One is we have institutions like schools, our educational systems, that are pretty much online, especially for older kids. I have a child in high school, and almost his entire high school existence is being conducted online. He reads textbooks online. He has to get information about assignments online, submit online. So telling a kid that age you can't use the computer means they don't have access to schoolwork. Then there's the peer network. Once all these tools are embedded and everybody's using them, it's not as easy anymore to say, I don't want my kid to use it. Everyone else, this is how everyone else is communicating. Because you're right, that's going to cut them off from really important peer interactions and information about their friends. Because a lot of that stuff is happening in the online world now.
What about the government? We hear so much talk about the privacy concerns that exist. And in fact, right now, there is a growing movement of people in Congress, in leadership positions, to consider antitrust restrictions on big technology because of fears that they're too big and privacy is disappearing and the control is being pulled away. There actually are supposed to be some protections for children
right now.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. There's definitely a role for legislation and policy here. What we have right now is something called the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA. You might hear it called that sometimes. And that was passed a couple decades ago. I think it was the early 2000s. And this was the law that restricted access to kids to websites and social media sites until they were 13. So if you're a parent right now, you might know that in theory, your kids aren't supposed to be on on any of this stuff until they're 13. But you might also know that most of our kids, I have an 11-year-old who's got access to everything. They lie about their age and get on some of these things. So that that particular piece of legislation hasn't been very effective, I think, is the general consensus there. And that's in part why we have some legislators who are proposing, you know, this time to update some of that, and that kids do need protection and that government should be intervening because of some of the concerns you raised, like privacy. National Public Radio, I think, just aired a story today about the autoplay feature on YouTube and how damaging that can be for kids. And that's one of the things that legislation, like the legislation that's proposed, would try to intervene in.
That's where you see one video, and before you can switch screens, you may have watched something that is absolutely appropriate, and then something else pops up, and
that's right.
You're hooked, right?
That's exactly it. And for kids who are just
like sugar
playing around on YouTube, or maybe even have been directed to something with their parents, and the parents think they're watching something appropriate, get moved into something that might be completely inappropriate because of that autoplay feature. So that's just one example.
Any research that you're aware of on smart speakers? We talk about how ubiquitous phones are. I cannot believe the number of people who tell me they don't have one, but they've got two, three, four smart speakers in their house, including ones in their kids' bedroom, which blows me away.
Yeah. I haven't seen systematic research about the influence of smart speakers on family, but I have seen a lot of commentary and debate about that. And there's the concerns run the gamut. But I think we started to see articles, I want to say in the last year or two, about kids who were learning terrible manners, right, because they were just used to barking orders at the smart speaker and parents were complaining about that.
And start talking to mom and dad like they're Siri, right?
Yes, exactly. Go get me. Turn on this.
Or mom, Alexa, mom, the interchangeable.
And I've also seen some experts comment on that and say that one of the concerns, too, is that again, for young kids who are still developing, they might not always be able to distinguish between Alexa and the other members of their family. So they might not know that the digital assistant is a digital assistant. And that really raises a lot of questions about the future challenges that we have moving forward. Many of the things that we're talking about now are going to become even bigger issues for families as we start to have virtual reality become an everyday part of our lives, as we start to have robotics enter our lives. That's something we haven't touched on much here, but that is already robots and caregiving, especially for older family members, are pretty ubiquitous in some other parts of the world. And they're definitely going to be something that probably many of us are going to be managing in the next generation.
And that technology is going to come whether we like it or not. We could be sitting in our home here in Milwaukee thinking, well, we're going to protect our kids from this. But the minute they walk out of the house, they're surrounded by it. So perhaps one of the lessons here is to at least begin talking to your kids or your other family members about how that technology should be used and not just presume that they're going to figure it out on their own. Huh?
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, in some ways, it is kind of a wild, wild west because policymakers can't always keep up with all the technological changes. So it is kind of up to individuals in some ways to figure that out for themselves. I think that is challenging for families. There's a lot of different things that you have to cover, and hopefully some of our other institutions like schools can also step in and help with that.
And there's also that privacy issue. I suspect a lot of people who have smart speakers in their phone, at least one in couple in particular that I'm thinking of, I don't think they've ever had the conversation about Do you know that the Amazons of the world that are promoting and selling the speakers are actually recording and retaining those voice recordings somewhere in the ionosphere? It's out in the clouds. And it's you. It's your personal conversations that are trapped there.
That's right. And there actually was just a survey done by the Pew Research Center about automation, just a broad survey. And it's pretty clear from looking at that data that most Americans do not understand how embedded AI, artificial intelligence, these kinds of surveillance technologies that you're talking about are in daily life. That's very clear. So I would assume that in this case, too, when we're talking about family life, that few people understand that.
So where does your research go? You've done so much work in so many different areas. What particular track would you like to pursue as you think about how you can look at technology and its impact on people?
Well, on the family side, I'm very interested in this question about what parents do and what the larger implications of their practices are. So I have some work I'm doing right now with some other researchers really trying to look at those parenting practices and think about these larger implications. On the work side, I'm very active right now in thinking about the role of what we call data science more generally. So it's big data, it's artificial intelligence, and how that's what the broader implications of that are for work, for workers, and for worker well-being.
Do sociologists see this as a new frontier? Is getting back to our earlier conversation about how in previous generations, there's always been some disruptive force or technology that has thrown people off kilter a little bit? Or is this all different? Do you think sociologists see this as a bigger challenge than before?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think that in general, sociologists are trained to take the long view. Many of us have learned about these earlier rounds of debate about technological innovation. So on the one hand, we do know it can be disruptive. There's lots of documentation that can be disruptive. So you do need to kind of figure out what that disruption is going to look like this time. On the other hand, we have historical models to look at to sort of inform us and help us with this round.
And your students, the sociologists of tomorrow, this has to be an incredibly exciting time for them to be in the field.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, we are so glad, Noelle, that you came and talked about your standing in the field. It's a swirl as we watch technology continue to be developed, and the impact on our lives is amazing, and we're glad you're here to talk about it.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Noelle Chesley, Associate Professor of Sociology and Director of the Undergraduate Studies Program at UWM's College of Letters and Science, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We look forward to seeing you next week at the same time. And remember, all of our programs, all of the UWM Today programs, are available as podcast. You just go to the WUWM.com website and you can download this and all of our previous programs. Take care. We'll talk to you next week. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.